You can't go! All the plants are gonna die!
I'm gonna take a bath.
Bad dates.
I'll alert the media.
Boys, keep off the moors.
It's evil! Don't touch it!
The name's Plissken.
No war! Hang on!
Welcome to Vintage Video, where we're rewatching the 80s so you don't have to. We'll be reviewing every major film release of the 1980s in chronological order, overanalyzing what you've seen and spoiling what you haven't. I'm Patrick O'Reilly.
I'm Jesse Bayless.
And I'm Richard Wells.
And today we're discussing Sharky's Machine, released December 18th, 1981. It was written by Gerald DePego, based on a novel by William Deal, directed by Burt Reynolds, and released by Warner Brothers.
Would it be DePego?
DePego, maybe.
DePego?
Gerald DePego? Gerald DePego? Gerald DePego? William Deal's novel, Sharky's Machine, was published in 1978. He passed along a copy to Burt Reynolds, who he had envisioned playing the title character even as he wrote the story. Turns out Deal was actually the third person to send Reynolds a copy of the book, as many considered it a good fit for his talents. Reynolds tried to talk Deliverance director John Borman into helming the project, but he was wrapped up in post on Excalibur and advised Reynolds to direct it himself.
Just do it yourself, Bert.
You
I ain't
do
got
it.
Time.
Orion bought the film rights for $400,000 and attached Reynolds to star and direct. The novel already took place in Reynolds' cinematic stomping grounds of Atlanta, so the project was a perfect fit. Stephanie Beecham and Cleo Goldsmith were both considered for the role of Domino on the way to Rachel Ward, who was actually hired several days into production. Sharky's Machine was the only 70mm release of the season, presented in a full 6-track Dolby stereo sound. I don't know if that's totally necessary.
Yeah.
In the early 2000s, Jerry Stahl was hired to write a remake with Steven Levinson and Mark Wahlberg producing, but nothing came of that project. The film also plays an important part in Venture Brothers' second episode, Careers in Science.
Yeah. Sharky's Machine.
Where it was playing at a space station in 1987, and there was a massacre during the screening.
Yeah, someone blew open the airlock and everyone got sucked out into
Wonderful.
Space.
He gathered everyone in the hangar for what he called movie night. And under the flickering light of Burt Reynolds' Sharky's Machine, he opened the bay doors. Almost the whole crew was there. Sharky's Machine.
We start with a sort of red pipe over black, and then a title for Deliverance Pictures, formed, as you'd assume, by Burt Reynolds after the success of Deliverance. This was the first of only two films to result from the production company before 1984's City Heat. On a dissolve, the red cylinder is transposed over a skyscraper and a negative still of the Atlanta skyline. The negative turns positive, and the still moves as a chopper encircles the building. Do you guys recall the last time we saw aerial footage of Atlanta?
Did gas take place in Atlanta?
No, that was in Kanata. But this was right before a basketball game.
Right before a basketball game.
Oh,
was it the one with the child that explodes things and shoots people?
It was a hard cut from an alien planet wasteland.
The hell is the name of that movie?
To a basketball game in Atlanta.
Yeah, I know the movie, but I can't think of that.
Because the people from space came here, so they were like
visitors?
The Visitor.
The Visitor.
See, I always think The Visitor is the one with the alien ninja stars and Jack Palance.
No, that's Without Warning.
Without Warning. Okay. Oh, my God. I was going to call it The Turning, but that's not it.
Nope.
Can't go. These names are so irrelevant to the movies. It's impossible to keep track.
All the names in the opening titles appear in a glowing neon font. Doc Severinsen's cover of The Crusaders' Street Life plays over the credits. This version was later reused by Quentin Tarantino in his film Jackie Brown.
I play the street life because there's no place I can go. Street life, it's the only life I know.
Do you guys recall the last time the opening song of a Burt Reynolds film was later reused in a Quentin Tarantino film?
Is it when it was when we covered?
Mm-hmm.
Cannonball Run?
It was not an 80s movie.
Oh. What did we cover in the 70s from him?
Deliverance?
Is that it?
Nope.
Gator? Or White Lightning?
White Lightning.
Okay.
Remember when he's breaking out of the prison and you hear...
Oh.
Bow, do, 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 bow. We see Burt Reynolds as the titular Sharky. No, this isn't a movie about a quesadilla toaster in a Mexican fast food chain. He's wearing a coat with a bag in one hand, walking along train tracks in fog. In a dark tunnel, he meets up with Harry Rhodes as Highball Mary doing a drug deal.
Well, before that, when he's making his way through town, he turns into an abandoned building and just full on punches the boarded up door.
Yeah, that's how you get in.
He doesn't even stop. He just Hulk smashes his way through this doorway and just keeps walking.
Mary wants to see the money first, and Sharky opens the bag, revealing a gun in his hand.
Diamond bag. Very pretty.
It bites, too.
Oh, ain't we mean.
They step out of their car to make the trade, including the gun in the bag, when another vehicle comes skidding up. Sharky assures Mary it's just a stranger turning around, but the driver shouts to them.
Hey, Sharky, you all right? It's me, Smiley.
Sharky makes a run for it, and Mary tries to shoot him, but finds the diamond back unloaded. They really don't bother to make this look like an innocent mistake at all, though.
Yeah.
It's clear already that Smiley was trying to get Sharky killed, and there's no getting around it. This could have been much subtler than it is.
But ends up almost getting himself killed.
Right.
Because this guy's got a freaking hand cannon.
Yeah, and he fires it right through the windshield of Smiley's car. Mary continues chasing Sharky and shoots past him once, causing a car to cartoonishly explode in a huge fireball from a single bullet. Mary grabs a pregnant woman off the sidewalk and drags her into a public bus. Sharky is met here by his partner, narcotics division head Jojo, who is furious that Smiley has interrupted this deal unprompted. Sharky makes a run for the bus and dodges a lot of bullets from Mary. Sharky taps his badge against the driver's side door, and Mary shoots the driver, bringing the bus to a stop.
Yeah, it's like...
You just got this guy killed.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, what are you trying to do telling the bus driver to stop? He can't stop.
Yeah. Haven't you ever seen Speed? The bus will explode. That's not...
His head. Right. That's his not, head
yeah.
will explode.
Yeah. The bus driver's head will explode. Sharky climbs in and gets Mary in the leg, and the two shoot back and forth for a while. Mary hits a civilian, and then Sharky pulls a lever to open the back doors so Mary can fall out into the street.
Is that the junk man?
Yeah.
Is he dead?
Why don't you shake him and see if he comes around?
As a result of the shot civilian, Sharky is busted down to vice in the basement. On the way out, he takes a second to shit-talk Smiley again.
What can I do?
Have a heart attack.
Yeah. Have two, Smiley. You bimbo.
The vice office is dark and cramped, crowded with prostitutes and Johns. Sharky passes Brian Keith as Papa and Bernie Casey as Driscoll on his way to the vice lieutenant Frisco, played by Charles Durning. Frisco points Sharky to his desk by the cage, which they've clearly been using as a trash can. Sharky puts an arm down and sweeps all the garbage to the floor.
You organize that real fast.
Frisco shouts at Papa for flirting with the hooker he's interrogating. Frisco assures Sharky that the guys down here are good at what they do.
They're top men.
They used to be.
Do you guys recall the last time we heard people referred to as top men?
Raiders of the Lost Ark?
That's right.
Top men.
The vice assignment tonight is to arrest any prostitutes near the speaking venue of the gubernatorial candidate Donald Hotchkins. They've even been told to make sure the cabbies are wearing their hats in accordance with some city ordinance that was just established. At night, the camera flies up to the same skyscraper from the start and follows an elevator up the building. At the top, Vittorio Gasman, as Victor, steps out with a girl on each arm. Blocks away, we see Henry Silva as Billy Score standing outside a building at ground level. Inside, we see Susie Pye as Sai Quan, a blind woman, loading a bong with powder and handing it off to a man to inhale from. You know what they say about blind prostitutes. You really have to hand it to them.
No.
I thought it was going to be they never see it coming.
Whoa. God, you guys. Both awful.
Billy. Billy Score scales the outside of the building and sneaks into a bedroom where Sai Quan and the customer lay in a spinning bed until Score shoots them both. Doesn't seem necessary to kill the girl if she can't testify against you, but as soon as he starts talking to her, we know she's not going to make it. I don't know why he bothered.
Hello, my sweet blind angel.
On the way to Hotchkins' speech, Sharky's vice team hear a radio call for homicide to respond to a double murder that we just cut away from. The boys send Sharky out to approach a prostitute named Mabel, who would recognize all of them from previous encounters. Right away, he gets her to agree to a price and then flashes his badge. We cut to the girls they've collared getting processed back at the station. Sharky is quickly tired of listening to Mabel and orders her into one of the small cages in the office. Her pimp, Percy, who came to get them out of jail, is allowed to leave on his own volition because he wasn't technically the one offering sex for money, despite being their boss. Mabel points out the hypocrisy of holding them and letting him go, but then says a bit more than she meant to.
He's gone free, right? Why? Because he's protected by the man. He's the man's favorite pimp. He's safe with his thousand a night thoroughbred imported. No, my God. You kill me. Percy. Percy.
Percy glares hard at the girl and approaches her cage. He pounds against the wall of it on his way out. Percy here, by the way, is being played by William Deal, author of the original book. Ironically, nobody probably would have thought twice about this interaction if Percy hadn't made such a scene about it. Turns out, in his haste, Percy left behind a wallet full of girls' names. Driscoll notes that all the names have exactly 7 letters, and Sharky determines that that means they are code for local phone numbers, and they want all 7 of these numbers tapped. What's confusing to me, though, is that the film seems to imply that these are the actual names of the girls, too.
Yeah.
So did they get custom phone numbers to fit each girl's names? Do they only hire escorts with 7-letter names?
I think they name them after whatever their phone number is.
Yeah.
So Domino's name is not Domino. She's just going by that name because they had a phone number for a Domino.
Do you think somebody was actually named Domino?
I don't know. Now I'm all self-conscious for thinking that.
We did have a woman named Solitaire.
And we had Saquon.
I don't think you could compare Bond girls' names to normal naming of humans.
Yeah, there was a Bond girl named Domino.
Yeah. But also, on what authority do they have to get wiretaps on 7 random phone numbers that they got?
They're suspicious.
I don't know that they... Do they get...
They get official permission for 6 of the 7. They request it for all 7.
Right.
And Homicide is curious about the number for Saquon because she was the blind girl that was killed last night. The department approved all the taps except for a girl named Domino, spelled with an E at the end, which they probably made her legally change so she could have a phone number.
I'm just imagining it like people trying to get email addresses now, and you're like, okay, what combination of numbers and letters are going to form a name and a phone number that's still available, and you have to keep calling back the company. Can I have this phone number? Okay, that one's gone. All right, let's keep playing like Boggle here and figure out how to do this.
None of these names are real names.
Yeah. Well, I worked for a guy, he wanted to get a new number for his office line. He's like, find me a fun number. It's like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, I'm giving him...
Just hit 2 for a while.
Yeah, exactly. He wanted some, like really fun to remember combination of numbers. And I was like, these are the numbers they got, man. I don't know.
It's like, here, this one's fun. It translates to fuckman. Easy to remember. Sharky says he has a guy that'll do the last tap for them if the department won't approve it. We cut right to Sharky arguing with Richard Libertini as Nosh, and things are quickly heated. But we see that they're actually old friends, and this is just how they talk to each other.
I'll tear you apart right now, you know, right here. I'll kick the shit out of you. I'll knock you to your knees.
Nosh's wife interrupts, carrying their daughter, Lisa, in search of a goodnight kiss from Daddy and Uncle Sharky. Do you guys recall the last time we saw Burt Reynolds being so enamored with children?
It's the paternity?
Paternity. Mm. We cut to the vice offices where the lieutenant is listening to recordings of the tapped lines and getting aggressively aroused by the nature of the calls.
Oh, God.
My nipples are hard.
Oh, hard nipples.
Nosh switches tapes to the forbidden line tap and asks the team to guess the man's voice on the tape. It takes the man explicitly bringing up the election for them to recognize it.
Hodgkins!
Hello?
Goddamn Hodgkins!
Sharky demands an around-the-clock tale on Domino in light of the gubernatorial candidate's involvement.
Again, under what suspicion? What is the...
They're $1,000-a-night prostitutes that are servicing the governor or the...
Governor...
Gubernatorial candidate.
It's
a big deal. It's something they should be keeping an eye on. He promises to handle the surveillance personally. Durning takes his energy up to 11 and starts shouting at everyone in the room, and it's a little overboard but very fun to watch. He even wanders into the background to yell at the perps in the cage.
You. You? You? You see, that's the trouble. Who else gives a damn? Who else gives a damn? You see, one-man show here. We gotta follow his routine.
The guys tell Frisco that they'll have to keep this under wraps because clearly the department rejected this tap for a reason and somebody's in on it. Nosh promises to rig the whole place for them, and we cut right to that happening. Unfortunately, their eyes on the road do a shit job looking out for Domino, and she's in the building before they get a first warning.
What happened is she's coming down the street. She's getting in the driveway. She's getting out of the... You know, you got a big communication problem here, Sharky. I didn't hear 110.4 in all that time. These guys don't know diddly shit about electronic communication.
They pretend to work on the elevator controls as Domino comes out, and she senses Sharky watching her and turns to smile flirtatiously back at him, and he smiles at her. We cut to some time later as he and Nosh keep an eye on Domino's apartment from the building across the street. Nosh talks about crushes from his past, specifically a girl in high school, and asks Sharky if he ever slept with her, since Sharky was always a ladies' man.
Did you? I mean, you can tell me now because what the hell, a lot of time has gone by. What am I going to do? You know, I'm not going to get mad at you. Did you? Yeah. Oh, shit! Shit, I knew you did. I knew it. Jesus, you were always doing that.
Domino is hanging out with her friend Tiffany across the way and having a chat. Sharky leaves Nosh alone here to watch the empty apartment and follows Domino and Tiffany to Athena Academy, a dance studio across the street from their building.
There's a lot of insinuation about what they're going to be doing because they keep Tiffany doesn't want to go because of the things that they make her do.
Right.
But then it turns out, it's just a really aggressive exercise class.
They're just exercising. We get a lot of close-ups of Domino's gyrating body, and then we see Sharky just creepily watching them through a window in the door. Do you guys recall the last time we saw a dude creepily watching a woman in a dance studio through a window in the door?
Was that also The Visitor?
No.
No, it was another one, though, where the guy had a kid and he was exchanging it with his wife.
No, this is a different one.
Oh.
I think you're thinking of the beginning of Harry's War?
Yes, I am thinking of Harry's War. But that's not this.
No.
Was it Saturday Night Fever?
No, but I think there is some dancing in
there's
that.
There's some dancing in that.
At a studio.
They're at a studio.
Some dancing in that film. But in this one, there's a woman that's doing dance choreography for an upcoming Broadway show.
Oh, that's not
Xanadu?
No.
That's not what I was thinking about. I was thinking about The Pit.
Oh, okay.
Where the kid's watching her and forcing her to undress because he's threatening that he's got his daughter.
Oh, right. And he's outside the window of her house.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, this is an actual dance studio. And there's a guy watching an actress he's obsessed with practice dancing.
The Fan?
The Fan is correct. Rachel Ward is so friggin' cute in this scene. Not as hot as when she was cutting off heads back in night school, but still very attractive. We get a montage of Sharky alone watching her, playing her piano, laughing to herself, and it's played like this is them spending time together building a relationship instead of just voyeurism. It culminates with the two of them in bed across the street from each other, singing along to a recording of My Funny Valentine. In the morning, she leaves to practice tennis at a court attached to her building so they can keep watching her from upstairs. Driscoll starts speaking unexpectedly spiritually about the tennis court, comparing it to Zen teachings.
You read any Zen?
No.
It becomes your universe, and you become one with that space.
He tells a story about a domestic disturbance he responded to with an armed man. He somehow survived with magic Zen powers.
What'd you do? Well, I looked down the barrel of that gun, and I thought, oh, shit. So I had to cease to exist. Do you know what I mean? I wasn't there. I pulled my antenna in, and I just, minimize my force field. Mm-hmm. I disappeared.
You disappeared?
Yeah, I wasn't there.
Next, we see Papa and Driscoll on watch, even though Sharky said he would take the lead on this one. Papa tries to get Driscoll to eat his trash food, but Driscoll is a sushi man. Papa thinks that's disgusting. Oh, hey, there's Sharky. Guess he paused for a shower, but he's back on duty now. A limo pulls up to the building and Hotchkins steps out. And as a completely unnecessary clue, we see Smiley left behind in the car instructing the chauffeur to pull away.
Yeah.
Is it possible that the guy who got Sharky busted down to Vice maybe is not a good guy? You think that's possible? As the car rolls away, Henry Silva as Billy Score steps out from the shadows with a briefcase. Upstairs, Sharky and friends get many photographs of Domino and Candidate Hotchkins together at the apartment. He's here to announce that he just bought her a house somewhere, and she's shocked beyond believing him because it's all she ever wanted. Their relationship seems more genuine than client escort.
Do you really buy me the house?
I swear the house is yours.
Her boss calls the apartment and demands Hodgkins leave immediately.
Why?
Because he doesn't want her to leave him.
So he's listening to her too?
Probably.
Okay.
Sharkey and friends hear the call and wonder who that was.
That was the man.
Sounds kind of foreign.
It's Italian.
That's what I said, foreign.
Sometime later, Sharkey watches Domino in bed, and when she walks to the living room, she finds Big Boss Victor. He's clearly upset, and it seems like she's planning an escape from Victor's employment, and a house means she can finally leave. Victor thinks she's still indebted to him and starts picking her plan to pieces.
Does he still think you're a dancer?
I am a dancer.
And across the street, Sharkey is offended on her behalf.
She is a dancer.
Even though he'll go back on this
later. Yeah.
Victor invites her to dance with him in the next room, but he's speaking in an easy-to-deduce code, and she turns down the request. He repackages the request, suggesting that she can have sex with him now to get out of their arrangement, and we cut to her taking drugs to dull her disgust in agreeing to be with this man. Sharkey is devastated to watch the object of his obsession go along with the plan, and we see Sharkey's eyes wet with tears as he backs away from a telescope that he's watching them through. The next morning, he watches Victor leave the place and copies down his plates, which are registered to Ibsen Properties, but we never follow up on that. He jumps off the phone when he sees Domino entering the apartment. On a cut, we notice Sharkey is not the only person on this floor watching the building. Billy Score is just a few doors down, watching just as intently.
I thought this was like a little bit silly.
Yeah.
And that
he's right next to him watching.
Yeah, exactly. And again, the funding that the police department has to follow up on prostitutes by renting out a high-rise apartment building.
Right. And it also, when we see it from this angle, we realize how obvious it is that there's a person watching her apartment all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, does she never look out the window?
Right.
Because she would see this guy just watching her through binoculars all the time. Score starts cutting lines of powder with a razor blade on his windowsill. He chases the lines with a handful of pills and then blows some residue out of the sill. The girl across the way undresses for a nap as Score heads downstairs toward her building. Sharkey hears the man buzzing at her door and senses something's wrong. He rushes to answer it. As soon as Score sees her shadow under the door, he levels a sawed-off shotgun at the peephole and screams like a maniac before pulling the trigger.
God.
Sharkey comes running, but as we see Score leave the hallway, we notice through the shotgun hole in the door that the shot has hit its target and the girl's body is collapsed faceless against the far wall. The shotgun has taken the whole front half of her head off.
This was shocking.
Yes.
Like, yeah. In no way was I expecting to see this in this movie.
Right. I agree. Sharkey pounds on the lobby doors with his badge till security lets him in. He tells the guard to avoid the man coming down.
Get past me! Stay out of the way!
I hear that.
Sharkey and Score nearly cross paths in the stairwell, but Score jumps out one floor above Sharkey and takes the elevator down. Sharkey follows, but takes the opposite elevator up and finds the faceless corpse against the wall in Domino's apartment. We cut forward to the rest of Sharkey's machine documenting the crime scene. They're hardly qualified to do this, but that's the cost of keeping the investigation under the radar. Frisco is not at all cool with the plan.
Again, it's not under the radar if you're getting judges to sign off on wiretaps.
Right.
I don't know how they could even think that they could do this. Like, I understand that they want to keep it and they don't want to pass it off to anybody mm-hmm. else, and they... You know, they might have their suspicions of people on the force not being trustworthy or people in government not being trustworthy.
But it's like, this is very blatantly a homicide. You can't bring this body to a morgue and not have it flagged as a homicide.
How can you do literally anything revolving around this case without telling the proper authorities? Like, yeah. I don't understand how they would even have access to the right stuff that they need.
Right.
Wait a minute. I see him, E. I see forensics. I see vice. Where the hell is homicide?
We didn't call him.
You didn't?
No, we want to do it.
Do what?
Handle it?
John Fiedler is the forensics guy, and he shares his thoughts on the murder weapon.
Probably a sawed-off shotgun, about 3 inches under legal, I should think.
A far cry from the stuffy professor type he was saddled with in his last Burt Reynolds collaboration, The Cannonball Run. It's fun to hear Piglet describing a gruesome murder scene, though.
This character of Barrett and his partner Twiggs.
Yeah.
They're a lot
That's
of fun.
That's the ME, yeah.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, though, he immediately repeats himself at the first comment again, like they just opted for another take and then left them both in.
Probably sawed-off shotgun. About 3 inches under legal, I should think.
Frisco asks if it's the same killer from earlier, but in his own angry, racist way.
This the same one who watched that chink hooker?
Asian. I'm checking on it.
Frisco is confused by the correction, and Papa blames Driscoll's education.
Asian? College.
Sharky doesn't contribute much to this whole scene and just stares blankly at the skyline before leaving suddenly. He's determined that whoever shot her was watching from the same building, so he's going to figure out where from. He busts into the only other empty apartment with Nosh and the forensics guy as backup, and they are not excited about being roped into this.
This scares the shit out of me!
Luckily for them, the place is empty. Sharky spots one of the pills Score dumped in his palm, and we get a discordant, jazzy montage of them taking samples of powder in the cell and testing it all, including muted shots of Fiedler announcing that this test's positive for PCP. They lift a fingerprint from the toilet handle. The drugs are entered into a computer database as Dilaudid, aka synthetic heroin, but Dilaudid is very creatively spelled here, with an alleged street name of D's, which would never fly today because every dealer would be like, oh yeah, I got D's. D's nuts!
D's get degrees?
D's nuts get degrees. We see Sharky's machine roughing up local dealers and testing different scatter plots to determine the sawed-off shotgun diagnosis. Sharky visits Hotchkins and arranges a private conversation with the man by simply mentioning her name.
Domino.
They step aside and argue for a bit. The confrontation is muted, but we definitely see Sharky break the news of her death. Driscoll visits a dealer contact named Kitten in the back room of a jazz club and shakes him down for a description of the buyer of the pill they found in Billy Score's observation deck. When the man clams up on him, Driscoll drags Kitten outside and throws him over a railing and crashing through a pile of garbage in the street below. Kitten is just about to give up the name of his buyer when Score appears over Driscoll's shoulder a block down the street. Kitten leans in close like he has something to say and then shoves Driscoll to the ground and makes a run for it. Inside, Sharky senses a problem and leaves to check on Driscoll. Just down the street, Kitten stops to catch his breath when he is suddenly, and quite unexpectedly, attacked by a pair of ninjas.
This is something I didn't expect to see in this movie.
They beat him unconscious, and by the time Sharky and Driscoll find him, he's dead.
They beat him to death.
We see Hotchkins waiting for a car on the street, and when he climbs in, he's meeting with Victor. He tells the man his feelings for Domino were real, and killing her was a step too far. Victor shushes the man and offers some advice.
You draw a clear, straight line to what you want, and you move. You do not stop. You do not go around anything or anyone. She would have stopped you, destroyed you.
No.
No. Stop the car.
I think Victor looks too much like Burt Reynolds in these wide shots.
Oh, interesting.
Like, just like the way they have his mustache and his hair.
Yeah.
Because, like, when the limo first pulls up, I was like, is that Burt Reynolds in the limo?
That's strange. He gives Hotchkins the offer to commit to their future relationship together, expanding power, or to leave now and return to a life of obscurity. Hotchkins passively agrees to the plan by not getting out of the car. Sharky's machine sit in to watch some baseball practice, and the LT shows up to check on their progress. Driscoll explains that someone has been tailing the team and that they've learned the shooter is a pill popper. As each member of the team speaks up with new info, Frisco positions himself 3 inches from their faces, looking totally confused. Nosh jumps in to mention that they've actually ID'd the shooter from his fingerprints. Nosh fills in the rest of the team that Billy Score has a brother named Albert and that they run a sex trafficking ring together with kidnapped young girls. He passes around a photo of the brothers, and Frisco intercepts it before Fiedler can get a look at it.
I didn't see it!
I don't give a fuck!
Frisco is so strange throughout the film that it often feels like they're overplaying him as a red herring. Like he seems completely drugged out and crazy all the time. He gives them a couple more days to close this case before he clues in homicide. Sharky heads back to Domino's place to check for more clues, and he's barely there a minute before Domino comes walking through the doors with arms overflowing with groceries. He thinks he's imagining her until she addresses him out loud. She assumes he's a boyfriend of Tiffany's and calls out to her, but gets no response.
If you don't get out now, I'm going to have to call the police.
I am the police.
Oh, yeah?
Sharky. Vice.
Which seems like a clear reference to Otto Preminger's Laura, in which the titular Laura shows up halfway through the film, completely unaware that police have been trying to solve her murder by shotgun to the face.
If you don't get out at once, I'm going to call the police.
But I am the police. Mark McPherson.
He points out the bloody crime scene she missed on her way in because the grocery bags were blocking her peripherals. Impressive that she missed the big cardboard patch on the shotgun holder in front of the door, though.
Well,
the door was open.
Oh, so she just walked right through.
Yeah. So I this whole scene, was going back and forth whether or not it was really happening because he was kind of fantasizing earlier about being with her. That I'm like, oh, he's imagining she's alive, and then this
that
is
they
all
could
gonna
resume their relationship.
Yeah. And then this is all gonna disappear in a minute because clearly she would have seen all the blood and guts, and she
or at
didn't.
Least smelled it on her way through.
Right. It's been a day or two.
It's been a day. You'd also expect some of the hallway to at least be taped off as a crime scene, but maybe that's homicide responsibility and Vice is just doing it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Domino is understandably devastated, and Sharky urges her to pack and get the fuck out of here before Victor realizes she's alive.
Isn't there a front doorman, too, that, like, because he
passed
the security
like,
guard.
Oh, hey, Domino, good to see you.
The person I thought was shot in the face.
He just doesn't want to admit he doesn't know anybody's fucking names in this building. The phone rings at her place, and it's Nosh calling to announce that all his tapes from their perch across the street and his office have been taken.
What are you talking about? All the tapes are gone?
Yeah, well, except the few I was working on at home.
Do you guys recall the last time someone lost all their tapes investigating a murder?
Blowout.
That's Blowout. Right.
Yeah. That's the one we watched.
They've erased all my tapes.
Because somebody erased it. They've erased all my tapes.
Or possibly An Eye for an Eye, because I remember that the woman in that film also recorded a lot of stuff and said that some of her tapes were erased.
The only things I know they took are some of my tapes.
Your tapes?
Nosh says that he's going to call home and urge his wife to take the kid and run. We get one last glimpse of Billy Score entering the building's elevator with the sawed-off shotgun again. Domino and Sharky hop into his car and drive through the rain to his place. Domino claims to have spent the last few days in the mountains alone, the same excuse Laura gives in that film. Domino seems to think Sharky is more than outmatched by Victor and refuses to help.
Just how big is your army?
A good man. You'll be all right.
More than 100?
4.
What?
4.
They enter Sharky's childhood home as a temporary hideout, and Domino is disturbed by photos of herself wallpapering the place. Sharky looks embarrassed, like he forgot he put them up, and we learn later that he just blatantly did, like he's like, oh, I forgot about the pictures. That's really embarrassing. He starts picking on Domino for being a prostitute in the first place and letting someone own her.
He owns you too. You're just too naive to know it.
Nobody owns me.
Sharky gives Domino time for a shower, but if you give a mouse a shower, it'll ask for a nap, and Sharky is quickly running out of patience. He needs Victor's last name to make things stick, even though we already know Victor's real name, because he is brothers with the shooter who they've identified. Domino still thinks the investigation is a lost cause and refuses to cooperate. Sharky gets physical with her, shoving her around and climbing on top of her on his bed. He throws her against the wall, and she retaliates by calling him a pervert and a peeping Tom, which he basically is. He reminds her again and again what she does for money, and she proclaims that she's a dancer, something he agreed with earlier when he wasn't in the room with her, but he's showing his true colors now. She still refuses to share Victor's name, and he starts slapping her around hard. That night, she wakes up in bed and sees him sleeping on the floor, just as he'd promised. The next day, we actually see some bonding between our lead characters, only this time they're in the same room. Sharky tells her about the school next door and how, even though it was close, he was always late to class as a kid.
You're a strange guy, Sharky.
Yeah. That's what everybody says.
We cut across town to Sharky's former partner in homicide, Jojo, with an urgent message for Lieutenant Frisco. It sounds like he found out about Sharky's investigation and wants Frisco to warn Sharky off the case to avoid something terrible happening. Frisco has more faith that Sharky can pull it off, but Jojo threatens to go directly to the DA and blow everything wide open, so a hitman behind the wheel of a car is engaged and crashes into Jojo as he crosses the street, and it looks like he's dead on impact.
Yeah.
Back at Sharky's place, Domino is impressed with his woodworking skills as she notices he's carved a rose in a door, although the pile of sawdust on the floor suggests that he has carved a dozen or so doors completely to dust.
You're a strange guy, Sharky.
I know. That's what everybody says.
It's not the first time we've heard a line needlessly repeated, and so now it seems on purpose, but I'm not clear why. Sharky and Domino begin making out, and he carries her back to the bed. Now comes the most infuriating scene in the entire film.
Yeah.
Sharky goes to a nightclub to confront Victor in person. He finds Victor sitting in a corner booth surrounded by beautiful women. He's here for no reason except to flaunt that he's made a rock-solid case against the man and intends to see him prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Totally unnecessary and purely ego-driven.
How does it feel? It feels great. It feels like you're a lump of shit. Lying in the bottom of a commode, and I got my hand on the chain, just waiting to pull it.
Victor seems to know Sharky surprisingly well and uses Domino as a weapon to piss him off. He mentions he found her when she was 12 and abused her until she became what he considers the perfect prostitute.
She was 12 when I found her. Can you imagine? I taught her, and I taught her until she began to teach me. Yes, she was the best, because I created her.
And here, Sharky makes the misstep of a century.
She's alive.
Sharky leaves, and Victor smashes his hands on the table in front of him. Sharky drives directly to Nosh's place to check on his friend and the last few tapes that haven't been intercepted by whoever's sabotaging their investigation.
But what? Okay, why does he do this?
I don't...
Because he wanted to see his face go from happy to sad. That's literally the only reason he's here saying this shit. It's so dumb. It gets a lot of his friends killed. This was really, really stupid of him. And it totally defeats the purpose of their investigation. Like, if Smiley had told Victor that, it would have been a huge blow to their investigation.
Yeah.
And so it's even worse that he's doing it himself for no reason.
I can't make sense of this scene.
The only thing I can think of is that maybe this scene wasn't there originally. And Burt Reynolds never met Victor in the whole movie.
Yeah.
And then it's just like, what is the point of this? At least they said something to each other. But then I don't know why Victor ends where he ends. So that's another problem. Sharky moves downstairs into the basement calling for Nosh and getting no response. The lights are out as well. He is suddenly attacked by the same two ninjas that killed Kitten earlier. He makes a valiant effort fighting back but is eventually knocked unconscious. We hard cut to a boat in the middle of a lake where Sharky is strapped down and slowly wakes up. He stares into the darkness across a table and a voice calls out from the shadows.
Hello, Sharky.
Hello, Smiley.
The man leans into view. It really ruins this moment that we already knew that he was the mole. I don't know why they showed us that.
Why do we bother bringing him out to this boat anyways? Why don't they just kill him?
Because they want to torture him for information. They need to know where Domino is.
Yeah, they don't know where the girl is.
I guess they don't know where she is, but I feel like, you know, you managed to get this guy unconscious. Just kill him. Like,
this is a pretty good reason not to tell them that she's alive, though, because then they have no reason to cut your fingers off because they think the girl's dead already.
Yeah.
Stupid. Sharky wants to fight back, but the ninjas are still here holding him down. They tell him it was stupid to confront Victor for no reason, and I agree. One of the ninjas starts swinging around a butterfly knife, and it's clear they intend to torture him for information, specifically the whereabouts of Domino, who, and I can't stress this enough, he should never have told anyone, was still alive.
Yeah.
Smiley explains that he has 10 chances to answer this question. For every non-answer, he'll lose a finger down to the knuckle. Sharky pretends not to know the answer, and they even give him a freebie to let him try again, but when he continues not to divulge her whereabouts, he winds up losing a couple fingers before Smiley inexplicably calls for a break and excuses the two men protecting him to go outside. What is the logic here?
Yeah.
Alone with Smiley, Sharky makes and executes a plan. Smiley notices Sharky reaching for where he hides a gun, and then informs him that they took all his weapons when he was unconscious. Sharky throws the table between them up off the ground and pins Smiley against the wall behind him. He yanks Smiley's service weapon out of its holster and shoots Smiley in the chest with it, and then kills one of the ninjas when they burst back into the room. He has to chase the second ninja up onto the roof, but runs out of bullets, so he kills the second ninja with a harpoon gun and then kicks him off into the water. The ninja looks appropriately surprised by this attack.
The cat and mouse, though, on the boat goes on
too long.
Yeah. So much of this movie needed to be trimmed. Right. But this was one of the scenes.
All the ninja stuff you can take out real easy.
Yeah.
The book actually deals a lot with Asia, and like there's even locations in Asia where they travel there for part of the investigation, but that's not a part of this story, so we don't need to see ninjas all of a sudden. Now we cut to the acceptance speech of Governor-elect Hodgkins. The crowd is very worked up and excited. Hodgkins starts repeating his promises to the voters, but catches a glimpse of Domino in the audience glaring back at him. It shakes him up, and he has a hard time continuing his speech at the sight of his supposedly dead girlfriend, until he finally just Mitch McConnell's at the podium. Papa and Driscoll are here on the sidelines and take the new governor into custody and drag him out of the building. Back at Victor's house, he and his assassin brother are arguing about the consequences of this setback. Victor doesn't really care. He thinks they can just buy whoever ends up governor in Hodgkin's place, but Score doesn't want to play these games anymore. Victor calls him a junkie and slaps his brother's drugs out of his hands while shoving him around the room. Victor tells his brother to just act normal and be more like him.
Act like you?
Well, try! I will. I will try.
All right.
I love you!
Victor hugs his brother tight and then walks away from him to open a bookcase to a hidden passage. As he walks away, Billy Score shoots his brother Victor in the back, killing him. Victor, the main villain of this film, has been killed by another villain of this film.
Yeah.
The next day, we see Sharky's machine, with additional policemen assisting, entering the building to arrest Victor. Sharky is livid to find Victor's corpse on the floor and just starts pistol-whipping the shit out of it in anger until he's dragged away.
He's dead, for God's sake, Sharky. He's dead.
Totally bizarre that they wouldn't give these two characters a final face-to-face. Sharky puts a gun in the face of an enormous henchman named Mongol and asks who killed Victor.
The brother.
Sharky assumes the shooter is still here and sends cops from all angles to close in on him. In the stairwell, Sharky sends Papa upstairs and Driscoll follows him downstairs. Papa calls out to Sharky from the door to the stairwell and Sharky tells him to stay put.
Don't move! It's the only way out of here!
Sharky and Score trade bullets for a minute and we see one hit Score dead in the chest with a full gloop of blood jetting out of his chest, but the guy keeps moving.
Fucking ghost.
We see Score recouping around a corner, and then Driscoll does some more repeating to keep the running gag alive, only we acknowledge it this time.
Sharky, the guy's a fucking ghost. I just said that. Yeah, you did.
They split up to surround Score and unfortunately overhear Papa getting shot in the stairwell. Turns out Sharky was wrong and there was another way out, but it's too late. Papa's dead. Driscoll cradles Papa's body.
It's not your fault, Papa.
And I wanted him to say, it's fucking Sharky's fault.
Yeah.
On another floor of the building, Sharky and Driscoll split up again. Sharky begins following a trail of bloody Benjamins across the floor, and Driscoll finds a whole bag of unsoiled cash. Score sneaks up on Driscoll, and the two shoot each other conservatively 5 or 6 times each before collapsing to the floor. Score puts his gun directly to Driscoll's head and screams, but never pulls the trigger for some reason. Possibly because Driscoll is using more Zen powers to not exist. Sharky arrives seconds later and asks where Score went. Driscoll has a lot to say and keeps calling to Sharky as he bleeds out.
Sharky, yeah. When you find him, you got to put him down.
I'll put him down.
Sharky.
Yeah.
Plant his ass in the ground, you hear me?
Yeah.
Sharky.
Yeah.
I'm talking about burying him and putting a stake through his fucking heart because he's not real.
I hear you, Arch.
Sharky.
Do you guys recall the last time we saw someone on the verge of death keep repeating the other person's name annoyingly?
Yes, because that's all I could think about.
What was that?
Empire Strikes Back?
No.
Oh.
More recently.
Ethel. 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 Norman.
Oh. Was it on Golden Pond?
That's right.
Ethel.
Yes. I'm here, Norman.
Ethel.
Yes, yes, yes.
Ethel.
What is it, Norman?
Well,
he wasn't actually dying, though.
Yeah.
I said on the verge of death.
Oh, whatever.
He's on the verge of death for that whole movie.
But yeah, Empire Strikes Back, when Yoda's like dying, Luke. But John Benjamin's version and the Family Guy version.
I don't know if I've heard that.
Where he just keeps saying, Luke. And Luke goes, yeah.
Yeah, what do you want?
Luke.
Uh-huh.
When gone am I, the last of the Jedi will you be, Luke?
Right here.
The Force runs strong in your family, Luke.
Haven't gone anywhere.
Sharky finally ignores the last call of his name and follows Score up another floor of the building. He finds another blood trail and locates Score standing with his back to the outside windows of the building. He's on the verge of death, but he doesn't bother shooting at Sharky. He wants to deny Sharky the satisfaction of killing him and moves to shoot himself, but Sharky shoots him first to prevent an unsatisfying suicide. Score is blasted backward through the window out into the sky, and we see stuntman Dar Robinson plummeting from the 16th floor of the Hyatt Regency downtown, and then we cut to a dummy falling from a much higher floor of a different building.
I mean, technically, this is still suicide by a cop, if you ask me.
Sure, yeah, that makes sense. At the time, this was the highest stunt fall in film history. Before he even hits the ground, we cut to Sharky pushing Domino on a tire swing in a park. And then as the camera backs away, we hear children laughing and the credits roll.
Yeah, we don't know if Driscoll survived.
He's fine. Papa's fine.
Well, Papa's dead.
No, Papa was dead before we left him.
Nosh is fine.
Yeah, we never saw Nosh's body, but Smiley...
Smiley said Nosh didn't make it.
Yeah. But we don't know what the results... Like, is Sharky fired? He should be fired, right?
Yeah. If he got bumped down for the person he was chasing shooting a civilian, then he should definitely get in trouble for getting the entire Vice Squad killed.
Right. Yeah.
By just blurting out secrets to the bad guys.
Like, did anything happen to the governor-elect?
He got arrested, so...
He got arrested, but... The only crime would be soliciting
the crime
a prostitute.
His only crime was love.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that right? That's what I tried, and my attorney just said, don't bother trying to convince him.
Because then also, isn't Domino then also going to jail?
No.
Why would she not go to jail?
Because Burt Reynolds will just kill everybody who tries to arrest her. He's super good at killing cops.
This movie should have been called Domino and not Sharky's Machine. Sharky's Machine is a terrible name. I'm just like, I just don't like it. It doesn't fit the tone to call it Sharky's Machine. I feel like coming into this not knowing anything about the movie, I thought it was a goofball comedy based on the name.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I did not think that. But I think that's because I know the cover box. And so I figured it was some like hard-boiled
detective. Yeah, I knew nothing about it. Thing. So coming into it, you're like, Sharky's Machine. It's like Pinball Summer,
yeah.
You know?
It sounds like the kind of movie where I'm going to see a human head sliced in half with a shotgun.
There were so many moments in here that I think I liked it so much because I was just not expecting any of this coming into it because I
definitely
knew absolutely
nothing.
I'm like, shot in the face. You know, cutting fingers off and like...
Yeah, that was brutal.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Especially when you see the hand pull back and the fingers are still on the table.
Yeah, yeah.
Just having her not be dead in the first place. Like.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. That was a cool twist.
I realized it was his left hand, but I thought, like, when he grabs Smiley's gun, when he tries to pull the trigger, he's like, ah, crap.
Yeah.
Like,
oh,
whoops.
Well. I guess I should have just told you after the second one, since you wouldn't have been able to pass on that information anyway.
Yeah.
I just kill all three of you.
Well, Smiley did say, like, he was like, we'll end it real quick if you give us the information. And it's like, so you cut off your fingers and you give them the information and they still kill you? That doesn't seem fair to me.
Yeah, that's, it's not the bargaining chip that he thought it was. It's like, hey, as soon as you give us what we want, we'll murder you. No thanks.
I like the version of this in Darkman, where the villain Durant has got the cigar cutter.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
cutting off people's fingers. He's like, I got 10 points to make here. And he's like,
oh, my God.
But when he gets the guy to confess after three, he's like, okay, great. Number four. It's like, it's like, oh, he's still going to go anyway.
That reminds me of... the Mel Gibson Payback, where they get him strapped into the chair and they're taking like a sledgehammer to his toes one at a time.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like asks him a question and then literally just smashes a toe until it's just sand in a big toe bag. Bone sand in a toe bag.
I will, you know, Mel Gibson feelings of him aside, He's great at getting hurt.
Yeah.
Like
he does that in all the Lethal Weapons too.
Like just the way he expresses just being in agony and pain and the grunting and gurgly sounds.
Whenever he gets shoulder shot and he's pouring alcohol over it. Yeah, I really enjoyed this film. It is not what I expected from a Burt Reynolds movie. This was him kind of aping Clint Eastwood's work as sort of vengeance for Clint Eastwood, kind of borrowing from his stuff, because Clint Eastwood started to move into comedies and Burt Reynolds is like, that's kind of my territory. Like
specifically ape comedies. Yeah. Is that why he's aping?
Yeah. But he was like, if you keep doing this, I'm going to have to like make Dirty Harry in Atlanta or something. And that was his nickname for this film for a while, because it's very much like a Dirty Harry movie. But I feel like Sharky never seems as fascist.
Well, yeah,
as Dirty Harry.
Yeah. Dirty Harry's an asshole. And Burt Reynolds isn't an asshole in this. I mean,
He's pretty awful.
He's kind of an asshole.
Yeah. But he's not like an idiot the way. Well, no, he is an idiot.
Yeah.
They're both idiots and they're both assholes.
Yeah.
But I like him a lot.
I like Burt Reynolds more as a person than I like Clint Eastwood. So,
yeah, I guess that's the difference.
So that's why we like this one better.
I feel like Smiley should have been part of the investigation.
Sure.
So you didn't outright suspect this guy who keeps showing up randomly.
Just replace Papa with him or something?
Yeah. So
don't take Brian Keith out of it, though.
No.
Maybe just add him as another member of the Vice team.
Yeah, he's part of the team, and then you start to wonder, oh, there's someone on the team you can't trust. Because at no time did I ever suspect, because once we see Smiley, it was like, oh, well, there's the guy on the inside.
As soon as he's like, hey, Sergeant, how are things going out there in the dark? What are you doing with that other man, Sergeant? Why was he even doing that? Because that's clearly a Vice operation. Why is, if he was on the homicide team, why is he even there?
Yeah.
Wait, he did it.
I assume he did it on purpose.
No, but I'm saying, why was Sharky involved in that? That's a Vice mission. That's not a homicide.
Oh, because it was drug related.
Yeah.
That's a great question.
Who knows?
Maybe that's why Smiley was surprised to see.
Anyway, I feel like even if they had just done that really obvious hint at the beginning and we didn't see Smiley again until he pops out of the shadows, I would have recognized him. I would have remembered this character because he stood out so much at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it would be better if you just dropped him for an hour and a half and then suddenly he came back at the end and you're like, I knew that guy was going to come back. But when you show him in the middle to be like, by the way, Smiley is the mole. Keep that in your back pocket. It's like, why did you tell me that?
There's going to be a big payoff later when you find out.
Where you find out, shit, I just told you. Fuck. Forget what I said, but remember him. Molly. this is great. It's a thumbs up for me.
Oh, yeah. I liked it. Yeah. Thumbs up.
I think this is my favorite like self-directed Reynolds performance. And I know it's the one that made the most money of the ones that he directed himself in. But I think he did Gator himself, but Gator's a little silly. I mean, it focuses more on the stunt work anyway, which, I mean, this film has some great stunts in it, but Gator has way more stunts in it. But yeah, what are we thinking Letterboxd for this one?
So I have it at number 20.
Wow.
Yeah, I liked it. Out of 174, it's below Eye of the Needle and above Raggedy Man.
All right.
I have it at 45, which puts it below Halloween 2, but above Whose Life Is It Anyway?
Okay. I have it in 50, which is just under Raggedy Man and just above Bustin' Loose. Like I said, our director here was Burt Reynolds. He also played Sharky. He previously directed White Lightning sequel Gator.
Really? Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure. I directed it.
And Dom DeLuise's buddy comedy The End. He played Quint on Gunsmoke. He's Gator. He's Smokey from Smokey and the Bandit. He's Stroker Ace, I think. I don't know. I haven't seen that one. He's in The Best Little Horror House in Texas, All Dogs Go to Heaven, Boogie Nights. We've seen him so far in Rough Cut, Smokey and the Bandit 2, Cannonball Run, Deliverance, White Lightning, and Paternity. And he has a cameo in Smokey 3, but he's not the bandit in that film. The novel here came from William Deal. He previously wrote and directed 1972 film The Secretary. And in the 90s, his novel Primal Fear was adapted into the Richard Gere film of the same name. He also appears in this film as Percy the Pimp. The writer here for the screenplay was Gerald DePego. He has mostly TV movie writing credits, but then in 96, his script Phenomenon was adapted into a theatrical release with John Travolta, and he later wrote Message in a Bottle and The Forgotten. The cinematographer here was William A. Fraker. He was an assistant cameraman on 39 episodes of the 50s Lone Ranger, and then earlier this season, he directed The Legend of the Lone Ranger. He has cinematographer credits dating back to the 60s on films like Rosemary's Baby, Bullet, and Paint Your Wagon. He lit Day of the Dolphin, Gator, Exorcist II, Heaven Can Wait in 1941, and so far on the show, we've seen his work for Hollywood Nights, and he's back later for Best Little Horror House in Texas, War Games, Space Camp, Tombstone, Street Fighter, and Vegas Vacation. The editor here was William D. Gordine. He previously cut Smokey and the Bandit 2 and Cannonball Run for our show. Later he cuts Stroker Ace, Cannonball Run 2, Dragnet, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 1 and 2, Beethoven's 1 and 2, and The Good Rocket Man with Harland Williams. The other editor was Dennis Verkler. So far we've seen his work on Burnt Offerings, Xanadu, and Continental Divide. He's back next season for Airplane 2, and later The Hunt for Red October, Free Jack, Under Siege, The Fugitive, Batman Forever, Daredevil, and The Fog remake, among many others. Vittorio Gassman played Victor. Don't recognize much of his work before or after this, since his credits are mostly Italian films, but he did come back in 1996 as King Benny in Sleepers. He also played Pacino's role in the original Italian version of Scent of a Woman. He was also briefly married to Shelley Winters in the 50s, Speaking of The Visitor. Brian Keith played Papa. He was Mitch Evers in The Parent Trap, Hardcastle on Hardcastle and McCormick, and we had him last season in The Mountain Men with Charlton Heston, and earlier this season in Charlie Chan and The Curse of the Dragon Queen. Charles Durning played Frisco. Before this, he was in The Sting, Dog Day Afternoon, and The Hindenburg. We've seen him so far in The Fury, Die Laughing, The Final Countdown, and True Confessions. After this, he shows up as the governor in The Best Little Horror House in Texas, and then Tootsie, Scarface, Dick Tracy, The Hudsucker Proxy, IQ, and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And Jesse usually brings up Doc Hopper from the Muppet movie.
You can't forget Doc Hopper.
I was reading up on his military career today. Durning was one of the first waves of the D-Day invasion of Normandy, sidelined for 6 months by a German mine explosion, and awarded a Silver Star, Bronze Star, and 3 Purple Hearts. Despite his claims in True Confessions earlier this season that he could not dance, Durning was actually a professional ballroom dancer and instructed at Fred Astaire's dance studio in New York. Earl Holliman played Hotchkins. He was Bob in Giant and Cook in Forbidden Planet. Bernie Casey played Arch Driscoll. He played in the NFL for both the 49ers and the Rams. He was the first African-American actor to portray Bond's American counterpart Felix Leiter in Never Say Never Again. He was Reuben in Cleopatra Jones. And after this, I think first of San Dimas High School principal. Was he the principal or the history teacher?
History teacher, yeah.
In Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And he's also the president of the Lambda 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 fraternity in the Revenge of the Nerds films, who he brings back a bunch of other alumni to help defend the nerds at the end of the film. Henry Silva plays Billy Score. We've seen him so far in The Manchurian Candidate, Virus, Day of Resurrection, and Alligator. He shows up later in Megaforce, Cannonball Run 2, Lust in the Dust, and Dick Tracy, among many others. Richard Libertini played Nosh. We've had him so far as the brother of a dead soldier in Catch-22, as a baggage handler in Out of Towners for our Patreon reviews last season, and as Giesel in our review of Popeye. He's also Fletch's editor, Frank Walker, Praka Lassa in All of Me, the voice of Wally Llama on The Animaniacs, and the voice of Dijon, the antagonist of the DuckTales movie, Treasure of the Lost Lamp. He's also Ed Rifkin in Bonfire of the Vanities. Daryl Hickman played Smiley. He was David Morris in William Castle's The Tingler and Bill Hero in Network. Rachel Ward played Domino. She landed this job on account of a Time magazine article announcing her as the face of the 80s. We saw her last for her first feature film, Night School, and she's back next season for Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid and later Against All Odds. She and Reynolds reunited in 2002 for TV movie Johnson County War, which tells the same story as last season's Heaven's Gate.
I say I like Rachel Ward in this Australian movie called Fortress.
Is that the Christopher Lambert one?
It's funny because there are two films around the same time called Fortress. This Fortress is she's a school teacher out in like the middle of nowhere, like teaching like a bunch of. It's like a varied age group because there's just not enough kids to fill a school. And these three masked gunmen come in, like one dressed as Santa Claus, one dressed as like Goofy, hold them hostage. John Vernon's one of the assailants. And like they take them up, put them on a bus and like put them in a cave to ransom them. But they go Lord of the Flies on the gunman.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like a Red Dawn situation.
Yeah, and they totally turn the tables on him, and it's great.
I feel like that would make a good triple feature with Red Dawn and Hornet's Nest, that other like Red Dawn-esque movie that we found. Joseph Mascolo played Joe Tipps. We saw him last as Peterson in Jaws 2, and he's Baby in Heat, but he's best known as Stefano from 1,847 episodes of Days of Our Lives. Is it Stefano or Stefano?
Stefano.
Did you see him in here? Stefano?
I don't recall seeing
him. I don't remember the name Joe Tipps.
I think that's Burt Reynolds' old partner.
Oh, JoJo, the guy who gets hit by the car.
Is it? I'd have to look again.
I mean, it's the only Joe that I can think
of. To be fair, when I was watching him on Days, he was much older.
Yeah. Carol Locatell played Mabel. We just had her as Mrs. Werner in Paternity earlier this season, and she actually just passed away in April. Harry Rhodes played Highball Mary. He was in Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, Detroit 9000, and we saw him last as Dr. Moreland in Coma. John Fiedler played Barrett. We saw him last season in Midnight Madness. He does the voice of Piglet. He's also juror number 2 in 12 Angry Men and Lawyer Daggett in True Grit. We saw him more recently alongside Burt Reynolds in The Cannonball Run. James O'Connell played Twiggs. He's a conductor in Who Framed Roger Rabbit and a bathroom attendant in The Cable Guy. Val Avery played Man with Saquon. We've seen him now in Brubaker, Gloria, and Continental Divide. He's also Henry in The Magnificent Seven and Chief Halliwell in Cobra. Susie Pai played Sai Quan. She's a Vietnamese prostitute in First Blood, but I recognize her most as Miao Yin in Big Trouble in Little China. She's the girl with green eyes.
A girl with green eyes. A girl who can tame the burning blade. Miao Yin.
She was the January 1981 Penthouse Pet of the Month and a Philadelphia Eagles cheerleader at the time of her casting at 19 years old. Tony King played Kitten. We saw him last as Davies in Shaft. Dan Inosanto played Chin Number 1. He was Pascal in Game of Death and one of the Wing Kong hatchet men in Big Trouble in Little China. And James Lewis played Policeman Number 1. He's Lil Pete in Roadie last season. Terrain Crawford played Woman. We saw her last as Todd's nurse in House of Dark Shadows. Lamar Jackson played Boots. He was Sugar Bear in Smokey and the Bandit. El Mongol played Mongol. He's a professional wrestler who performed as El Mongol. Bill Nunn played Kitten's Bouncer. He was Robbie in Spider-Man 1, 2, and 3, the second in command at the Bugle. That's like he works in the same office as J. Jonah. But he's probably best known as Radio Raheem in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. Those are all the credits I have for this one. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share, you can find all our socials at linktree.com/vintagevideopod. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time when we'll be discussing Modern Problems, which IMDb describes like so. Jealous, harried air traffic controller Max Fiedler, recently dumped by his girlfriend, comes into contact with nuclear waste and is granted the power of telekinesis, which he uses not only to win her back, but to gain a little revenge. It's like that Super Trooper movie,
yeah,
but with Chevy Chase as the cop. Okay. But he's not a cop.
Isn't it Zapped also?
Yeah, it's very Zapped-ish. We leave you now with the trailer for Modern Problems, starring Charles Chaplin. No, that's a different movie.
Chevy Chase is Max Fiedler.
Got any tuna?
An air traffic controller who's losing control.
350. Hold there, friend.
350 for tuna?
Copy your correction. Coming in at 350 from Tunis.
Not you, Tunis. Maintain 325.
He lives a modern life. With a modern girl. Modern friends. And modern problems.
What seems to be the problem here?
Well, his girlfriend moved out on him yesterday, and she took everything in the apartment, and now she's here with some guy.
That's fair enough. She wanted it, she took it, he let her.
Everybody dumps on Max. Until a nuclear shower gives him the power and a green light.
Oh, it's true.
To get even.
Max.
Now he's out of control. And about to make this the funniest Christmas ever.
This is demon powder.
Now, he touched that, he died.
Nobody knows.
Chevy Chase. He's got hot brains.
I like it.
And modern problems. Patty Darbinville.
Did you see that?
Mary Kay Place.
I'm Max.
Nell Carter. And Dabney Coleman. Modern Problems.
I blew it. I was a bad boy.
Modern Problems. It'll glow on you.
Street knife. Gonna stab you with a knife. Street knife. Gonna poke you with this knife I found. Street knife. Yeah, I found it in the street. Street knife. And I use it when I eat.